Good morning, New Hope. That was weak. I won't make you do it again. Good morning. Thanks for that. It's good to be with you guys. Hey, maybe it's your first time here. Welcome. If it's your first time coming to New Hope, maybe you're visiting. Shout out to my parents. My parents are visiting. If we haven't met before, my name is Kyle Denny. I'm one of the pastors on staff. I oversee high school and middle school ministry, which is just the best. If you're a high school or a middle schooler, I think you're the best. We are going to be in James chapter 3. We've been doing a small mini-series through the book of James. We did it last week. We're in it this week. We're in it next week. James chapter 3, verses 13 to 18, if you want to flip there. There's Bibles around you. We'll also put the verses on the screen. Hey, if you don't own a Bible, we would love to give you one. We would be delighted. We'll even ship you one if you're viewing on live stream. Hello that way. But yeah, we'd love to get the Bible into your hands. I have two announcements before we read our passage. The first one is related to youth group. I'm going to use this as a free promo. We have two summer events coming up. We have a launch event for middle school where we're going to go to launch and have a great time there. That's on the 14th. You're allowed to bring friends as long as they're in middle school as well. No older siblings in high school. Sorry, can't go. I know, Luke, you're sad by that. Second thing is we have a high school event where we're going to do a trivia night on the 17th. And so those are our last two summer events. And then we hop back into it on the 24th. And so if you're curious about what is youth group, what do we do there, kind of who are some of the leaders, we have a table in the back today with a youth group banner. You can sign your student up that way. You can get on the parent email list. That's where we share all the details. We don't share all the details all the time with the whole congregation, but that's how we keep you in the loop. So if you're interested, it's back there. You can also talk to me afterwards. Would love to meet you. The second thing is Pastor Mark said that he would be sharing update statuses of phase two throughout the summer. And so leadership team has asked me just to share kind of where we're at with phase two, what pledges have come in so far. And so I'm not going to put the number. Tech is going to put the number up on the screen of what we're at. So far, we're at $6,360,000, which is amazing. Like, that is the generosity of New Hope. Yep. If you're curious about what is phase two, what are these pledge cards? We got a booth in the back with more information. We'd love to tell you about it. And then if you haven't filled out a pledge card yet and you would like to, if God's pulling your heart in that way, it's not too late. You can keep turning them in. That pledged amount is obviously dependent on our congregation approving the facility expansion. That hasn't happened yet. We will do a congregational vote. I think it's in the fall sometime. But don't quote me on that. You can ask Pastor Jeff or Pastor Mark. They would have more information. All right, James chapter 3, verses 13 to 18. I'm going to read this in front of us. Who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder in every evil thing. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. And the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. This is the word of the Lord. Hey, if I stood on the opposite side of you on some type of topic, some extra biblical topic, not specifically stated in the Bible, maybe it was on diets, maybe we disagreed on what was the best diet, if there's any dangerous diets out there, maybe it got a little more heated and differences on parenting. Maybe it's on, should we vaccinate our children or not? Should we sleep train our children or not? How do we school our kids? Private, public, homeschool? Maybe it's in politics. Maybe we differ on political parties. Maybe we differ on certain subjects like gun rights or immigration or student loan forgiveness or climate change. Maybe we differ on pandemic and COVID. What was the right response to that? How should that have been handled? If we had disagreed on any of those, would I be attracted to the way that you disagreed with me? Would our disagreements end up causing unity, even if we disagree? Or would it have caused division with the way we disagreed? That's going to be at the heart of our passage. We're looking at spiritual maturity, and part of it is discerning spiritual maturity. What is spiritual maturity? What is wise and understanding? What is not? And that's important. But also, we have what the spiritually mature do. What is the challenge of spiritual maturity? This is my claim. Community is held together by spiritually mature people, and community is destroyed when they are absent. Now, if you were here last week, we were in James chapter 1, verses 2 to 4. No, I will not ask you what we talked about. Don't worry. But we are skipping all the way to chapter 3. And I just wanted to say that's not normal. Normally we go verse by verse by verse, but we got 3 weeks, and so I'm making executive decisions here. We're going to chapter 3. Last week we talked about James was saying that maturity was being perfect. Not in the sense of flawless, but in the sense of being whole, being complete, not lacking anything. And today we're going to take a slightly different angle on it. We're going to look at maturity with a different viewpoint. If chapter 1 was focused maybe on our relationship with God, our spiritual maturity to God, we're going to see chapter 3 come out across with how we relate to other people. Still dealing with our faith, still dealing with how we trust God and what God has to say, but it's got more of a horizontal bent to it. If we would have continued on from our passage from verses 2 to 4, if we would have went to 5 to 8, we would have seen that James says that we're growing into the spot where we lack nothing in the Lord, but if someone lacks something, if they lack wisdom, they should ask for that. What we see is that wisdom and maturity are linked tightly together, where if there is a trial that has slammed into you and you don't know how to get through, biblical wisdom, God's wisdom, is going to be your light. It's going to guide you through it. What does it look like when someone continually asks for God's wisdom, who continually seeks God's wisdom, who applies it to their situations again and again and again as they go through life? What does that person look like? That's what our passage deals with. He says in verse 13, "Who among you is wise and understanding?" We see that the author James gives us a self-evaluation. When you look inside your heart, when you look inside your life, do you consider yourself wise and understanding? Now, just for some context, in chapter 3, verse 1, we skipped it, but he tells his audience, whoa, not many of you should be teachers, right? And then he seems to backpedal and he says, okay, not many of you should be teachers, but who is wise and understanding? Because we need all the wise and understanding people we can get. There is a role, there is a job for you. Well, what is wise and understanding? And who are we comparing to? Like, I don't mean to boast too much, but I'm pretty wise and understanding compared to my kids. You knew that was coming. I know not to stick my finger in that electrical socket, right? I know a lot of answers to their questions. I can be pretty wise and understanding compared to them. But if you compare me to someone like Pastor Mark, I got some ways to go, right? And so when we say wise and understanding, who are we comparing ourselves to? I would argue that's the wrong question. It's not who we're comparing ourselves to, it's what. There is only one time that this Greek word for understanding is used in the New Testament. And that's such a James thing. He has all these words that are only used once in the New Testament. And it makes it hard for comparison because we can't compare it with different contexts and kind of root out more of the meaning. But if we look at the Septuagint, if we look at this Greek translation of the Old Testament, Old Testament's normally written in Hebrew. This is a Greek translation of it that was around in James's day and was used in James's day. we see these two words for wise and understanding pop up in the Old Testament. We see them pop up in Deuteronomy. It says in Deuteronomy 4, verses 5 to 6, this is Moses talking. "See, I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should do thus in the land where you are entering to possess it. So keep and do them, for that is your wisdom and your understanding in the sights of people, who will hear all these statutes and say, 'Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people.'" Who is wise and understanding? Not the people that just have this vast amount of biblical knowledge, but those who are applying it to their lives, who are following after God, who are keeping his commandments. New Hope, you are wise in understanding. If you are making a habit of following after God well in your life, where you've taken your life, and as trials have slammed into you, instead of having your faith buckle, you look at the word, you look at God's counsel, and you trust it. You apply it to your lives. This lines up with the Old Testament. When we look at Proverbs, Proverbs would say, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." In the context of James, I'd say wisdom is faithfully applying God's truth to our lives in a practical way that draws us closer to God. James is asking, who is following after God well? And that there's a technical term for wise and understanding that's almost like an expert. You know, it's someone who has been in the trade for a while, who knows their trade, who maybe has a new problem they've never encountered, that they're able to look at their experience and apply it to the new problem. It's almost like these are the people that have followed God long enough and well enough that they are learning to think God's thoughts after him. Clearly, this is a bar that James expects that we can get to in our life. Now, saying that you are wise in understanding, that feels boastful, doesn't it? Like, that's kind of like an audacious claim to say, like, I am wise in understanding. But look at where James goes with it. He says, "Who among you is wise in understanding? Let him show by his good behavior his deeds." He's not asking us to tell him. He's not asking us to raise our hands and say we are wise in understanding. James says the wise in understanding are going to show their spiritual maturity. It's an invitation to anyone to show their wisdom and their understanding to others, to not identify our words that we're spiritually mature, but with our actions. That word for show, it's actually the same word that Jesus uses when he shows the marks of his crucifixion, when he invites his apostles to come and feel the wound in his side, the wounds on the arms and the legs. He is showing, he is inviting them to visibly display his identity of who he is. James says, show. Show with your life that you are wise and understanding. He says you're to do this by individual deeds, by these little things that come along in life that make up the course of a good behavior. That word for good is a Greek word, kalos. It's beautiful and good. It can indicate a couple different things. It can be flawless, it can be morally good, and it can be beautiful with the sense of attractive. And the context is how we know which one of those that we need to pick. I think there's good evidence to use it in the sense of beautiful and attractive. That seems to be the way Deuteronomy is using it, right? Deuteronomy talks about as they keep these statutes, as they keep these judgments, the other nations are going to be drawn in by that. It's going to be a beacon that is attractional, that they're going to say, look at this great nation. They are a wise and understanding people. I think James is using it in the same context, the same way. We see the spiritual mature are to do two things. The first, they're to show their wisdom through an attractive way of life. And that certainly fit the way that James himself lived. Our author was known as James the Just by other people. It's not like he was calling himself. Other people referred to him that way because he was a humble man. He was a man who always did the right thing. And he was a man that cared for other people deeply. There's actually a first century Jewish scholar named Josephus. And he's not a Christian. He was a Jew, but he never became a Christian, never believed Jesus was the Messiah. And he actually writes about James, the half-brother of Jesus. And he describes how James died. He says that he got sentenced by the high priest to be stoned to death and that he was killed in this manner. But then he goes on to link James's death with one of the reasons that the temple and Jerusalem itself was destroyed by Rome. Evidently, James had such a godly character that even Jews that were not Christian were attracted to it. They saw the goodness of it, enough to say that there was so much injustice in his death that it led to the destruction of the temple. Now, whether or not that's true is kind of irrelevant for my point. James had an attractional life. There's some church tradition that would go on to say that when James dies, he dies proclaiming the gospel from a height. He falls. The fall doesn't kill him. And while these Jewish people are picking up stones to kill him with, he's praying for them. Right? Like, that is attractional. James is not one who raised his hand and said, "I'm wise and understanding." He's one who revealed it through his actions. When things are hard and there's disagreement between two parties, maybe you're one of them. Maybe you're on the side of one of these conflicts. Do you live your life in a beautiful way in which outsiders would be drawn into it? Or does our sin nature tend to get the best of us in these scenarios? I remember back when I was a waiter in my hometown, there was one night that I had the owner of the restaurant sitting at one of my tables, and he had like seven of his friends, and he was playing host to all of them, so he had lots of requests, which is good. You know, he's allowed to do that. But I had three other tables, and I didn't want to mess up the order of the owner's table, and so I was paying extra special focus on this table, and I neglected one of my other tables. And when the bill time came around, and I handed the bill to the father figure of the table, I still remember what he said. He could have been annoyed with me. He could have been sarcastic with me, like, "Man, I can't believe the service in this place." He could have shouted angrily at me about the poor service that I gave him. He could have just not said anything at all and just given me a really bad tip and let that be his notice that I gave them poor service. Instead, he was very gentle with me. He acknowledged, he said, I know that things around here are pretty busy, but it feels like you neglected our table a little bit. In the future, it might help if you check on your tables more. And then he left me a huge tip, a tip that I did not deserve, a tip that was bigger than the owner next to me ended up giving, right? That was an attractive way to live. 16 years later, it's still with me. Now, if you contrast that, there was this table of Christians that I had on a different night. I don't know when it was, after, before, whatever. And after I got done serving them, you know, I gave them the bill, they left. They had a crisp $100 bill with $100 peeking out of a salt shaker. And I got so excited. I'm like, "Whoa, that is a huge tip. That is undeserving." And I picked it up and I unwrapped it. It was a gospel track. Inherently more value than a $100 bill, yes. Truth, yes. Very unattractive. Very off-putting the way that truth was delivered. Now, if they left a real $100 bill and that would have been different, right? But they were very unattractive with the way they delivered that truth. We're to show our wisdom through our deeds. That there are individual works that God is placing in our lives that we are meant to do. And they're meant to be just a piece of the beautiful life, the attractive, godly life that we live out before other people. But then he adds on to the sentence with another clarifier. He says, let him show by his good behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. I love James because he uses words like the gentleness of wisdom. Like, no one really talks like that anymore. What is he saying with that? In the Gospels, Jesus has a saying in Luke 7. He says, yet wisdom is vindicated by all her children. Vindicated is to be shown in the right, to be proven correct based on what you're providing. Jesus is saying we can know that we have wisdom by what comes out of it. This wisdom gives birth to children. And notice, wisdom is vindicated by all her children. It's kind of like the fruit of the Spirit, right? The fruit of the Spirit is made up of multiple different things. It's not just one of those. All of those come out of walking with the fruit of the Spirit, and all of them should be present. And so wisdom is going to give birth to all kinds of different things, but James narrows in on gentleness specifically. He's shepherding his flock, and one of the things that's crucial, one of the things they need to know is that this attractional, beautiful life that's to be lived out is to be done in gentleness. Like, that is a direct result of applying God's wisdom to your life. The Greek word for gentleness is praites. It's the quality of not being overly impressed by a sense of one's self-importance. So when we read in Philippians 2 that Jesus counted equality with God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, it's saying that Jesus the Son, pre-incarnate, and God the Father were not having an argument before humanity was created. Jesus was not digging in his heels and saying, God, I don't want to go down to the earth. Like, I don't want to leave heaven. Have you seen earth? It's going to be broken. It's going to be destroyed. Like, I'm the one that all things are created through. What's the Holy Spirit doing? Send that guy, right? I want to stay in heaven. That's not how Jesus acts. Jesus is not ruled by his self-importance. He's ruled by his love for others. That doesn't mean that Jesus doesn't have self-worth. It just means that that's not the thing that's steering him. You look at sinners and prostitutes that come to Jesus, they felt welcome by Jesus. It's not because he relaxed the truth, but because he was gentle. He dealt with them in an understanding way, in a tender way. Proverbs would say a gentle answer turns away wrath. Well, that's who Jesus is. When we look at us, we have this broken, sinful nature, right? Where we tend to look at our job, we look at our performance, we look at our intellect, we look at our wit, we look at our beauty, and we get warped in ourselves where we think that we are self-important. We are overly impressed with our self-importance, and it can rule us. The gospel absolutely destroys that. Right, that is the stumbling stone. That is the narrow path. And it's that we are not enough. We are not so self-important that we can bridge the gap to our relationship with God. We need Jesus. We are never enough. Even after we accept Jesus, we're still not enough on our own. We continue to need Jesus. We need his death on the cross to pay for our sins. We need his righteousness that's applied to our life to be seen as holy and righteous before the Lord. Those two things, that's going to destroy pride. That's going to pull the plug on self-importance, especially when you pair it with the fact that aside from God, I can do nothing. Right? Unless I'm plugged into the branch, I can do nothing of eternal worth. That cuts my self-importance down. And when we believe that, when we see the gospel, when we understand that deeper and deeper and deeper into our lives, and then we apply it to others, like we see others through the lens that they also are not enough, that they also are covered by Jesus, it takes the harshness out. It produces a gentleness. It produces an understanding when we remember the gospel. It's not identity-based, or it is identity-based. It's not works-based. When you look at the man that confronted me in the restaurant, And he did it gently, and he did it wisely. I didn't just need to know that I had screwed up. I needed the grace that was going to build me up along with it. The spiritually mature are to do two things. The second thing is they're to do all their acts, and they're to be characterized by gentleness. And this is the challenge of spiritual maturity. As we walk with God, this is what we're all called to do. And if you're like, whoa, 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 Kyle, I didn't say that I was wise and understanding. You told me to look inside. I know I'm not wise and understanding. Nope, still applies to you. Read the next verses. He says in verse 14, but in contrast to this way of life, if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, demonic. Where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder in every evil thing. Again, James asks us to do a self-evaluation. If you look inside and you see that there's bitter jealousy and selfish ambition, that's going to be seen in our lives. When Adam and Eve are first in the garden, God gives them wisdom. He says, don't eat of this tree. This tree is going to end up killing you. But then you have Satan come slithering in, and he gives another kind of wisdom. He gives another kind of viewpoint, and he says, you're not going to die. That's silly. This tree is going to help you. You're going to be like God. And obviously, if you've been in church a while, you know that when Adam and Eve eat the fruit, it instantly goes bad, right? Disorder and every evil thing instantly enter into humanity. We just need to look at how Adam reacts to God to see it. God confronts Adam. Adam, did you do this? Shoves his wife in front of the bus, right? Yes, but it was the wife that you gave me. It was the woman's fault. So not only does he shove his wife in front of the bus, but then he implies very slyly that God is actually the one to blame, right? It's the woman whom you gave me, God. There is division, there is disorder, there is every kind of evil thing that comes from selfish ambition and bitter jealousy. It's as though there are two wells that we can go to and try to nourish ourselves from. Two things, two ways of looking that we can try to draw life out of. We can go to the well of the gospel, and we can drink in deeply that we are to die to ourselves, or we can go to the well of the demonic that teaches that, no, 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 you should self-prioritize yourself, that you should be thinking about you first and foremost. And the question is, which one gives life? Which one will actually nourish us? James is going to give us discernment of what well we're drinking out of. How do we know if we're wise and understanding? The way we know is what's in our heart. And if you're like, I don't know what's in my heart, what came out of your heart? What are some of the actions that resulted from what was in your heart? We see in Proverbs, it says, watch over your heart with all diligence, for from it flows the springs of life. Out of our hearts, out of our mindsets, are going to flow our thoughts and our actions. And if our hearts are filled with bitter jealousy and selfish ambition, that will be seen in our life. That will be seen around us. There will be disorder and every kind of evil thing. Now, bitter jealousy here, jealousy is just a word that means very strong feelings towards, strong devotion towards. We might say zealous. It's not automatically bad. It's when you add in bitter jealousy that it starts to become a strong longing of negative feelings over someone else's achievements, over someone else's success, over their stuff. It's an envy that's in our lives. Someone has the job that you wanted, the friends or the spouse that you wanted, the vacation and the ease that you wanted, the health that you want. And there is this anti-wisdom that feeds it, where we can take a drink out of not the well of the gospel, but the well of the demonic that says, yeah, I deserve that, not them. That should be me. We try to nourish our souls with it. And he pairs this with selfish ambition. Now, I hear selfish ambition. I think, well, what's wrong with that? Right? Should I not have a zeal? Should I not have a desire to grow a business? Should I not have a desire to seek after good things for me in life? That's a fair question. The answer is no. It's not automatically wrong. You can seek after those things. But to whose glory? Like, it's one thing to grow your business to the glory of God in a way that loves other people. It's another thing to grow your business in a way that brings glory to me, that's only for my selfish interests. You could take that with anything: friendships, college education, jobs. The word for selfish ambition is a word that means self-seeking. It's aretheia. It's an attitude that you're willing to get what you want by stepping on other people. Where these two mindsets are present, where we have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition, community is destroyed. Instead of an attractional way of life that draws people in, it pushes people away, and we're isolated. We're left feeling distant and alone. And in a small way, right, like a small seed form, tell me that this doesn't happen with our conversations, where someone has the attention, someone has something exciting that they're sharing, and we hear it, and inside, we may not even know it's happening, we get jealous of that attention. We get jealous of that spotlight. And so we jump right in to try to take it back from them. It sounds something like, oh man, I'm so sorry that you got bit by a dog. I got mauled by a bear once. And you instantly, like, you steal it back with a better story. You steal it back with how you process that same feeling. And in any conversation, there's always going to be give and take. I'm not saying that you should never share an example of your life. But I think a lot of times we would rather take and have the attention on us than listen well to the other side and ask them good follow-up questions. This comes from our hearts. Right, that this can come from our broken nature, that even if we believe in Jesus, there is still flesh that's wrestling there with the Spirit. James frames this as a hypothetical. If you have these things, if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition, but if we just read more in the book of James, right? Like we read to chapter 4, we see that his audience, his community is being destroyed by bitter jealousy and selfish ambition. This is not an if, it is present. Look at what he says. If you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. The sense is if you see this, if you see these works in your life, if you see this in your heart, do not put this on a pedestal to be celebrated. This is not wisdom. We are to confess our sin. We're not to boast in it. We're not to hold it up as this is the way. The more that this bitter jealousy and selfish ambition is in our lives, the more we're trying to draw nourishment from it. And he says the more we obscure the truth, we deny the reality that's actually there, that we are not self-important, that we can do nothing apart from God the Father. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, demonic. Again, earlier in the letter of James, if we were to look at chapter 1, James would say that every good gift is from heaven above. And he's contrasting this, and he's saying, this is not from heaven. Right? Like this wisdom, this mindset, this pursuit of these things is not a gift from God above. It's actually something else. And if you've ever heard of the unholy triad of temptation, the world, the flesh, and Satan, these things that tempt us, this is actually where it comes from. He says, wisdom that is earthly shuts out God and fails to consider him. It doesn't care about heaven. It doesn't care about God's reign. It only cares about the here and the now. It shuts out anything godly related. That's a worldly influence. There's also a natural influence. Wisdom that is natural is what comes out of our fallen sin nature. We would say what comes out of our flesh, if the Holy Spirit wasn't in our lives regenerating us, wooing us with the gospel, how would we act? Probably how the flesh would act. The last one is demonic. Probably doesn't need any description. It's a behavior that is instigated by demons. We would say it's from Satan. It's satanic. And if you turn to this wisdom, if you drink from the demonic well, if this is where you're looking to for your nourishment, this is what you're looking to for life, this is what's really going to get by in life, he says that something's going to happen. The actions are going to be disorder in every evil thing. And he contrasts it in verse 17. He says, but the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. What you get are two very different pictures. One wisdom leads to disorder, leads to every kind of evil thing. The other wisdom, gospel wisdom, true wisdom, wisdom that's from God, it leads to unity. Now, that word that he starts out with is very important. He says, from above is first pure. The primary thing that this wisdom is about is godliness. Pure is a word for innocence. It's a word for moral blamelessness, where there's no moral defects. And that's immensely important because he's going to go on with seven more words to describe what this wisdom is about. And it's about bringing peace into our lives. But it's never peace at the expense of godliness. This purity, it's godliness. That's first and foremost what this wisdom is. The next seven words he uses, he starts with peaceable. And it's trying to bring harmony. It promotes a state of wholeness, an attitude that tries to heal division, that wants what's best for the other party. Again, not at the expense of purity, not at the expense of godliness. But if I were to look at your social media accounts, right, would I see that you are trying to heal divisions, or are we pouring salt in wounds? Right? Are we concerned about the other side? Or are we trying to do what's best for the other side? Or are we grandstanding? Are we trying to show that we are right, that we are the ones that are in control? Is our pride puffing up, or is our love going out? The second word is gentle. It's a different word that was used earlier in our text. It's a word that's more about leniency. You're yielding. You're tolerant. Man, in our parenting styles, if we have disagreement on what the best way to parent is, if we come to a different conclusion on vaccines or a different conclusion on the right schooling fit, are we tolerant of that? Or do we slam each other in our conversations? Do we produce division? Do we produce disorder by our words? Reasonable is the third one, willing to be persuaded. It implies goodwill and mutual understanding. It opens a dialogue, and it's willing to see the other side. Do we need to talk about politics? Right? Like, when someone has a different understanding of us, someone is in a different political party, someone stands on a different side of an issue, are you someone that people would go to talk with? Will you listen reasonably to them? Will you try your best to understand their side, to hear the high points of what they're claiming? Or do we just steamroll people? Do we shut people out because they don't have the right answer in our eyes? Are we reasonable? Are we full of mercy and good fruits? Are we overflowing, right? Like a cup that's filled to the top, that's overflowing? Are we overflowing with mercy and kindness and concern for other people in need? Something that we act on that produces good fruits, that good deeds are produced on behalf of the needy. And if we go all the way back to COVID, right, which no one wants to do, but if we go all the way back to COVID, did we have mercy on someone that was on the other side, that saw things differently? Did we continue to do good things? Did we continue to speak well of them in different areas? Or did we just slam them with our conversations? Did we just put them down in our mind and behind their backs? Unwavering, we're stable, we're trustworthy, we're transparent, we are reliable. If we look at our friendships, do we cancel people in our life that don't share our viewpoints? And if we get in a fight with someone, do we just shut the door to that friendship? Or do we hang in there with them? Are we seeking after them? Are we trying to build bridges with them? People with different viewpoints, are we extending our hand in friendship? Are we earning the right to speak into their life? Last one is without hypocrisy. It means that the things that we're doing are not for some hidden reason, but for what is there. In any of these subjects, and more of these subjects than I shared, is there any self-righteousness that's masquerading as truth? Is there any envy or jealousy that's really behind the way that we are responding? When I ask myself those questions, I see situations in which a trial slams into me and my faith buckles. I was not those things. And that's the beauty of the gospel, is that you are still loved, you are still accepted, and what we're called to do is not to put it on a pedestal and boast that this is wisdom, that what I'm doing is right. It's to confess it. It's to say that I wasn't drinking from the well of the gospel. I was not dying to myself. I was drinking from the well of the demonic. What came out of me was natural, earthly, demonic things. Now, this doesn't mean that we're avoiders. This doesn't mean that we fail to have hard conversations that will benefit others. I think if you look at church history, there is a lot of harm that comes when we avoid tension instead of when we meet it with gentleness. Again, there's leniency, there's tolerance. We don't have to be nitpicky where we're picking on everything about everyone, but the mature are not avoiders. We're reasonable, we're peaceable, we're not avoiders. A wise and understanding person is going to bring unity to the relationships around them. If we look at verse 18, we look at the way he capstones his passage. He says, "The seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace." Now, this could have been possibly a standalone parable that was floating around in James's day. If that's the case, he works it into his passage to say, this is what I'm talking about. He says, there is a righteousness. There is a way of following after God which does not appear unless our aim is peace and unless we are the peacemakers that are doing it. Jesus would say, blessed are the peacemakers. Well placed. You're exactly the place you need to be if you are a peacemaker in your life. Peace is not just an end of hostilities. I think when I hear peace, I'm probably tainted by just a lack of tension, right? That's not the Old Testament understanding of peace. Peace in the Old Testament is the Hebrew word shalom. It means to be whole. It means to be healthy. It means to be complete. Shalom is used of prosperity, of physical health, of salvation itself. There's one scholar that wrote, it includes the creation and the upholding of an environment of truth, honesty, righteousness, and justice. Those are all things that a community needs to flourish. Those are all things that peace brings. Back to my initial claim, community is held together by spiritually mature people, and community is destroyed when they're absent. Two things of application, one observation, one question. Observation, wisdom works itself out in the presence of others. And that means you cannot be spiritually mature and neglect community. Your beautiful, attractive way of life is meant to be seen by other people. If there's no community, if there's no one that our lives are involved with, there's no one to see it. That also means that when there's spiritually immature people around us, we're not meant to exclude them. We're not meant to push them away from us. We're meant to run towards them. And you may think, that's really hard. I don't want to do that. Well, what well are we drinking out of? The well of the gospel that dies to ourself, or the well of the demonic that self-prioritizes ourself? These are hard things. If there is community that is destroyed around you, if there's community that is absent around you, you are needed. You are to take God's truth, apply it to your lives, and chase after it with gentleness. Second thing is a question. Wisdom is applying God's truth to our lives. Is there anywhere that you personally cause division or disorder in your actions that you can ask someone forgiveness for? Man, that's really hard. That's awkward, isn't it? And yet, if we're a people that never confess our sins, then we're a people that are obscuring the truth. The truth is that we're sinners, that we need a Savior, that we continue to need a Savior now. And if we never confess our sins, we're using our actions to say something otherwise. The way we relate to one another is going to show the depth of our wisdom and our understanding. And if you're like, man, I'm in, how do I do that? How do I become more gentle in my life? It goes back to some of the basics we talked about. The first one's the gospel. The more you believe the gospel, the more you apply the gospel to your lives, the more gentle your actions are going to be. The second is when you fail to do it, we confess. We ask people for forgiveness, and we get back to it, applying not so that we can make it to heaven, but that so we can find true life, that we can follow after who Jesus is, who God is.